Papalism, the Authority of the Church, the seventh talk in a series titled Historical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 20, 1996, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
The topic tonight is papalism and the authority of the church, and the series, as you remember, is Historical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity. Our agenda in this series is to try to look at things that, from our perspective, whether right or wrong, from our perspective are a mistake, are ways of misconstruing what the Christian faith is all about. And in hopes not so much that we want, not so much that we're concerned about the ways people have gone wrong, as we want to know how to get it right. So our emphasis is more on what can this teach us about what is Christianity about, rather than a concern so much in how people have gone wrong. And the way I'm going to approach it tonight, I say that because the way I'm going to approach it tonight is not so much concerned with papalism. And by that I mean belief in the authority of the Pope in Rome. I'm going to approach it more from the standpoint of what really is going on there. What's the view of Christianity that's embodied in that as the outcome? And how does that compare with how we should look at the Christian faith and what Christianity is all about? So let me begin by looking at this handout that you have and look at a kind of historical development. And that's probably a misnomer, because I'm not going to, and nor would I be capable of, giving you names and places and quotes on this topic. I just haven't been interested enough to explore that. And it really is not really at the heart of what I want to accomplish here anyway. This historical development is my judgment, my analysis, and it's only as good as my thinking is. So, you know, certainly other people may disagree with this, but my contention would be, it seems like there's two things that are happening early on in the church. I mean, like, really early on, that as they come together, result in the view of the church and the view of the authority of the church, and ultimately leading to the granting authority to the Pope. These two things are what I call institutionalism, I'll define that in a second, and Greek gnosism, and I don't say Gnosticism because I don't mean Gnosticism. Gnosticism is a very particular religious point of view, and that's not what I have in mind. So let me define these things. Actually, let me start with Greek Gnosticism first. It's second on my list, but let me start with that. I didn't give it this name, but this is the thing I was talking about a couple weeks ago when we were talking about Greek rationalism and the effect that it's had in history. What I really have in mind is the tendency within the Greek philosophical intellectual culture to see the purpose of human existence, and therefore the fulfillment of human existence, as being to know. If I can just know what there is to know, I will be happy. It strikes us as odd in a way, really. It's not a part of our culture. I don't know if it ever has been a part of this phase of human history. It's a very peculiarly Greek kind of thing to have the emphasis on knowledge as actually a fulfillment of the essence of who you are. As Aristotle said, among other things, man is a rational animal, and that was the basis upon which, and that's his articulation of your essence, is to be fundamentally rational, And for that reason, if you are going to be fulfilled in your essence, it will be your rationality that is fulfilled. And how is rationality fulfilled? Well, a lot of things you could say about that, but in time, one of the answers that was given to that is, if you could just have the right set of beliefs and be able to say, I know. How that ultimately affected the church, I think, is that it led to this thing that Ron was talking about last week, creedalism. It led to metaphysical speculation. It led to doctrinal statements. It led to an insistence on doctrinal orthodoxy and doctrinal purity. All that was so vitally important to the early church because that's what life is all about. What life is all about is that we can finally know. Knowledge is my fulfillment. Knowledge is my salvation. The right set of beliefs will save me, and the right set of beliefs will fulfill me. Sounds weird, but in that particular cultural setting, I think they had all this momentum, cultural momentum, that would reinforce that kind of position. Now, what I suggested a few weeks ago is, I think that's ultimately fallacious. That's not the biblical view. The biblical view is not that we are, that our essence is rationality. We are rational, and that's a big part of what it means to be a human being, but it's not the sum and substance of what it means to be a human being. And that, in fact, we probably shouldn't abstract any one thing out, but if we were called upon to abstract one thing out, from a biblical point of view, I don't think it would be rationality, it would be morality. What will fulfill me, a far better answer to what fulfills me, is not knowing the truth, but being good. That's a far better answer. Even that may not be adequate, but it's a far better answer than the ones that the Greeks would have given. Roger?
But part of being good is knowing what good is.
That's true. But it's the smallest part, because there's a lot of people that know what good is who don't be good, be it.
And people who are good who don't know what it is?
Probably.
Mm-hmm. He says knowing
good. Not in the way that the Greeks would want you to know, for sure.
Knowing good is an existential knowing, not a rational knowing.
Right.
So yeah. It's different.
Right. Yeah, see that... It's important to see, for the Greeks, they went in two directions, and sometimes both at the same time. One was in the direction of mysticism, that is, that the kind of rational, the fulfillment would come through a mystical, intuitive experience. Or, if they weren't talking about that, then where does my fulfillment come? By being a speculative philosopher, by giving arguments and giving reasons and giving evidence and coming to know exactly how to articulate this doctrine about this thing. And I mentioned this, and we'll talk more about this, I think it's next week, like in the Trinitarian controversy. You know, why were they so consumed with articulating this doctrine of the Trinity in just exactly the right way? Why was that so important to them? Of all the things in the world to worry about and to puzzle about, why speculative metaphysics rather than the doctrine of justification, for example? Well, because there's so much momentum in that culture, that's what philosophers do. That's what people who are really hip human beings, who really know what human beings are all about, that's what they do. They do philosophy. And they do metaphysics, and they come to the right answers about the questions of ultimate reality and natures and essences and la la la, that sort of thing.
What's so, the name of my mind that I'm writing down is that verse from Deuteronomy, the secret things belong to the Lord,
right.
But these belong to you, these are what you have to do with.
Yeah, exactly. And that's Greek gnosism. What I'm defining as Greek gnosism is the violation of that. Is, no, 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 the secret things are for us to find out. And if we are just if we're just good enough philosophers and theologians here, we'll sort all this stuff out. And there's a drive to do that. And so what that ends up doing is being a drive in the direction of doctrine, doctrinal purity, and even that wouldn't be so bad if the doctrine had to do with things like, what must I do to be saved? And getting clear on that. But it wasn't even that. It was, now exactly what proportion was Jesus and divine human, and how did they relate to each other, and did they mix or not mix, and like, how could we know? I mean, isn't, if anything's a secret thing, isn't that one of the secret things? And yet, it was that kind of speculation that just drove them early on.
Would you define metaphysical or
metaphysical? Well, at least the way it came into the church, it would be things like, in the Trinitarian doctrine, how did they finally end it? God was one substance but three persons is how they ended up. We'll talk about that next week. Substance is straight out of Aristotle. The fact that you would even think in terms of substance is a metaphysical question. And that is, what kind of stuff is God? In the question of the incarnation too. What kind of stuff is Jesus? Is he made of God stuff? Or is he made of human stuff? Or is he made of both stuffs at the same time? And are those stuffs mixed together? Or are they kept separate? Those are metaphysical questions. They're asking about the nature of what is, the nature of reality, the nature of essences, the nature of things. And in this case, God things. What's the nature of those God things? I mean, this is crucial, so don't. Make sure that you understand what I'm saying here. Do you see how different the questions that the Reformation was worried about are from the questions that the Trinitarian controversies were made of? The questions the Reformers were asking is, what is it that has to be true about me if I'm going to enter into eternal life? That's a personal question, it's a vital question, it's a relevant question, and it's an answerable question.
So would that be a philosophy of religion as opposed to a metaphysical? Because it is answerable?
I'm not sure what I should call it, but it's not metaphysical. That's not a metaphysical question.
Okay.
But to ask the question, you know, but see how different it is, and they killed each other over how they answered that question, you know. So they weren't real nice to each other. But earlier they had killed each other too over the question of, now Jesus is both God and man, so I think he's made of both God stuff and man stuff. And one person would say, and I think they're intermingled. And another person would say, and they don't intermingle at all. And I'm going to kill you for thinking that they do. Now, do you see, never mind the fact they killed each other. I mean, my point is not the ethics of that, but do you see how fundamentally different the kind of question it is? I don't think it's vital. I don't think it's revealed, and therefore I don't think it's answerable. I mean, the Bible is certainly not discussing that question. Yet the metaphysical speculations start from certain information and data that the Bible gives them and then go from there. But they're all on their own. You know, the Bible is not helping them advance any further. They're just starting like on a trampoline. The Bible is the trampoline from which they jump into lofty heights, you know, and they answer all these questions. That's not true of the doctrine of justification, for example, the Reformation. They are digging deep into the Scriptures and allowing the Scriptures to answer those questions and trying to come to terms with what is the Scripture saying to us about that. I mean, fundamentally different kind of question. And the point I'm making is, why did they so quickly engage in metaphysics? First generation, out of the chute.
So it should not be said that the Christians have metaphysical debates or attitudes?
Well, Yeah, that'd be going too far. I mean, it's not that there are. It's not that the Bible says nothing about metaphysics. Metaphysics is a hard term to come to terms with. Here's what short lesson on metaphysics. In the Middle Ages, Aristotle's works were put in a book, were compiled and put in a book. This book here was called Phusis, Physics. And then there was another book that got in the volume, was the next one in order. They didn't know what to call it, so they called it Metaphysics, which means after physics. It's the book that they put in the volume, bound in the volume, and put it after physics. Well, it just so happens that what that work by Aristotle concerned itself with were questions like, what is real? What does it mean to say that something has being? What is being? You know, what is existence? What's the nature of existence? Those kinds of questions. So from then on, in philosophy, anytime questions concern themselves with those sorts of questions, like what is being, what is real, what is existence, what is the nature of existence, what is the nature of things, what is the essence of things, those are considered metaphysical issues or metaphysical topics or metaphysical questions, because they're very, very foundational questions about the nature of being and reality. So that's roughly what metaphysics means. Now, the fact that we say God exists and he transcends reality and is the creator of all reality, well, that's a metaphysical doctrine. We're talking about what's ultimately real, and we can talk about the nature of God's existence. God's existence is such that, like theologians say, that God has self-existence. His existence is not contingent on someone outside of himself creating him, like ours is. His existence is complete and sufficient in and of itself. He couldn't not exist. That's how God exists. Well, that's a metaphysical doctrine. But I think that's a metaphysical doctrine that is at least clearly implied by the view of God that the scriptures take. So I think it's fair to say the scriptures teach that metaphysical doctrine. So it's going too far to say that Christians don't believe any metaphysics. Right, right. Yeah, now what makes it speculative, what makes something speculative metaphysics is, let's say that you and I were sitting down over coffee one day and you asked me, you know, how does God do that? How does God self-exist? And I actually deigned to answer that. And furthermore, you disagree with me. And we get in a fight over how it is that God can self-exist. I mean, as if we would know. We're clearly engaging in speculation. We have no basis whatsoever from experience or biblical authority or anything else that gives us any guidelines to decide how it is that God can do this thing, self-exist. But we decide that we've got to know and we've got to have an answer, and you better be right. And we're going to fight you over your wrong answer. That's what the early church did. That's what the first generation after the apostles began doing right away. You with me? Okay. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, there's this other phenomenon, and I don't know where it comes from. It may just be human. I mean, it just may be built into human sinfulness and rebellion and evil. Or maybe there's something in Greek culture that fostered this too. If there is, I'm not savvy enough to grasp it. But it's this thing that I call institutionalism. And what I mean by that is simply that, at least in Christianity, salvation is administered by the church, by institutions, by these organized bodies that have rules and structure and things. Institutions are the locus of our salvation. I can't even remember who said this, probably somebody famous, but one of the early church fathers said, no one can have God for a father who does not have the church for a mother. That's a statement, an eloquent statement of this institutionalism that I'm talking about. And talk about early. I mean, this is right off the bat that the early church fathers were just insistent on the churches as being the administration of this grace of God bringing salvation. It comes through the structures of the church, the liturgy of the church, the rituals of the church, the teaching of the church, the offices of the church, the sacraments of the church. It's the church that is going to be the basis of our salvation. And it's incredible how early that was. Okay?
And it has its basis in what?
I don't know.
I mean, it's not a cultural movement. It's not an already existing religious belief. It's not... is it like it was part of an old structure that just got carried along?
Could be. I mean, you do have things like the mystery religions, which were pretty hot items at this time. And, I mean, the thing that's a little weird is that the mystery religions were more like...
Maronites?
Marcionites?
Yeah,
I mean, that they were sort of a mystery religion. They're actually sort of Gnostics in character, but that's sort of a... They're more like secret societies than they are... I don't know, they seem a little bit different to me than what the church ended up being. So, but the fact that you do have liturgies and secret code words and offices probably... You have people that would be leaders of these little secret societies. So there were structures there that were identified with your salvation, and I suppose that kind of concept was certainly in the culture. But why would the Christians have thought at all to look there? That I don't know. As I said, maybe it's just a very human thing to do. I mean, just maybe it doesn't need a lot of cultural momentum, that we're just already predisposed to want to think in those terms anyway. I don't know.
One church history book that I read a number of years ago, one of the things that stuck out to me early on in the first century, actually the first two, three centuries, maybe even sooner than that, a lot of the people who were coming to the Lord were, or at least so they say anyway, were people that were very highly educated. And they were almost immediately, a lot of them, not saying all of them, but a lot of them were put in leadership roles. And so I, right then and there, the warning signal went up to me thinking that a lot of these philosophies, whether it be Greek or whatever else they were into, could have immediately entered into the church because of that. Mm-hmm. And obviously you get into the partiality type thing where obviously these people were probably educated, they could have been had more money, so on and so forth, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know enough about the time and the culture and the currents there to have any independent opinion about that. I'm not sure where this came from. But what is striking is that it came. I mean, it's very striking. Is there anything wrong with that? I think so, and this is probably a controversial claim. I mean, there's all kinds of people in all kinds of religious traditions and all kinds of Christian traditions that would violently take issue with this. But it seems to me that fundamentally, biblical Christianity would in no way lead to this kind of institutionalism that I'm talking about. Yes, the New Testament talks about the church. Yes, the New Testament talks about deacons and presbyters and pastors and that kind of thing. And I'll come back to that. We'll get to what is the New Testament talking about then. But it's one thing to acknowledge social relationships and social interaction and the structure of those interactions. That's one thing. It's a whole nother matter to think that those social relationships and those social structures are your salvation and define the whys and wherefores of your salvation. That's a big leap, a whole nother issue. And that's what happened early in the church. Roger?
Well, I can see how that might happen if at first the church was highly persecuted. they would try to make sure that no one would come in and I mean, they probably had to meet in secret, so they had to have secret ways of telling where and when the meetings were going to be held and that kind of thing. And in a way, to screw up could mean death.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that big of a jump to go from preserving your life to preserving your soul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a mistake, but it's not. I don't see that as being a big jump.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's possible.
Create an authority structure mm-hmm. between towns and whatnot.
Yeah. It would require a high degree of organization and therefore structures. Yeah, that's a good point. Now, what I would suggest instead is that biblical Christianity is what I have in the past called a form of existentialism. And it may be terribly misleading to use that word, but it works for me, and so let it work for you. What I mean by that... Well, we are talking about popes here. So. What I mean by that is not, you know, don't think in terms of all those mean, nasty things you've heard Christians say about existentialism. What they've said about them is true. When they're talking about the atheist existentialists, and they are the bad guys, and that's a terrible point of view, and it would be very destructive. But what I mean by existentialism is that when all is said and done, the most important questions in life that I face as a human individual is, what am I going to do with this human existence that's been given to me? What am I going to do with it? How am I going to invest it? What's going to be the project that I set for myself? What does it mean? Where does it gain its meaning? Where does it have any meaning and any significance? And it seems to me that those are exactly the kinds of questions that biblical Christianity is vitally concerned with. I mean, Jesus is clearly an existentialist in the way he teaches and the way he preaches. Don't lay up treasures for yourself here on earth where this stuff can happen. Lay up treasures for yourself in heaven. That is, here's what you should do with your life. Here's how you should invest your life. To do this would be folly. To do this would be wise. That's speaking to an existential question about what should you do with your existence. The fact that meaning and purpose and fulfillment of my existence is ultimately going to be found in the fulfillment of the promises that God has made in the gospel. That's where meaning comes from. That's where meaning to human existence comes from. That's where value to human existence comes from. That's a very existentialist perspective, to be asking that question and seeking an answer to that question, an answer to yourself. That's what I mean. And ultimately, therefore, what makes you or I a believer from a biblical perspective is that we've taken a certain perspective in answering the vital existential questions. We have believed that the hope of the gospel should be my life project. We've set that as the most important goal of my life. We believe that the promises of the gospel is the only thing that can really give value and significance to my life. We are committed to that. We believe it's true with a deep and abiding passion that makes that more important to me than anything else that this world has to offer me. That kind of existential commitment is, in biblical terms, what makes me a Christian, what makes me a Christian believer. What made you a Christian believer in the first century? You belonged to this institution. You see how fundamentally and radically different that is? So I'm arguing, from a biblical perspective, the apostles, Jesus, I don't care what institution you belong to. What is the passion that's driving you? Is it a love of God? Is it a desire to know Him and seek Him? Well, then you're a believer. You're a child of God. I don't care what institutions you belong to. Institutionalism says, I don't care what you want out of life. I don't care what's driving you. I don't care what passions are working inside. What institution do you belong to? And have you been baptized? Are you a member in good standing? If so, then that's what it means to be a Christian. It just, you couldn't get further apart in terms of the criteria that's being applied.
He just used the term to know God, which kind of trips me up.
Seek to know God.
Seek to know God, and that kind of takes us back to the metaphysical side of things we were talking about earlier, and I don't know how to balance that out.
Well, because I think knowing God in the way... I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Knowing God in the way that the New Testament is talking about is not knowing God's nature. It's not knowing his essence. It's not engaging in speculation about God. It's more empirical than that. It's based on life and experience in the world. Who is this guy who's running this place? And it's more about knowing the heart of God, knowing the purposes of God, his agenda, things about him in the way that you do in a relationship with a person, in the way that I say I know my wife. I don't engage in metaphysical speculation about her essence or her nature. I, through experience and through living with her, come to know her. And I think that's more what the Bible means by knowing God.
If you continue in my word, then you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free, is extremely existential too.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so far so good. Point three on this outline. Furthermore, the way this institutionalism in the early church got institutionalized, I think relies a great deal on Plato and the philosophy of Plato. And let me explain. Did I talk about this? Plato is famous for what's called his theory of ideas. And what that amounts to, in a nutshell, is a book. It's a particular book. I could burn this book. I could destroy this book. I could turn it to ashes and make it so it's not a book any longer. But somebody else could come along and take some paper and print it and put a cover on it and make this very same book all over again. So... even though this particular book here in my hand right now may come and go in life and experience, why is it that we are capable of recreate? Why would we be able to recreate this? Well, it's because something is still around when this particular book is gone. When this book has been turned to ashes, the idea of this book, the concept of this particular book, has not been destroyed. It still exists. And some other bookmaker could take that idea, that concept, and make it concrete, make it tangible again, bring that down into this phenomenal world. So Plato, believed that there exist in reality, and in fact that they are more real than the particular things of the world, these ideas or concepts that the stuff in this world, that the particular things in this world are simply reflecting, they're simply participating or reflections of or an embodiment of those ideas, those concepts. Pardon?
Is he referring to mathematics?
Well, mathematics is a sort of an ideal example of that, yeah. The number two is a concept versus actually two things, for example, the idea of a triangle is perfect and flawless, but you could never make an actual triangle out of something in this world that's perfect and flawless in the same way. So the idea of the triangle is even more real than any particular triangles that you'd bump into on the street. They transcend this world that we experience, yeah. Now, I think Plato is right in many respects. He's saying a lot of good stuff there. The question is, is every concept like that? Later, in the Middle Ages, a group of people called nominalists come along, and their perspective is that concepts don't exist. They're just made up by people. as a convenient way of using one word to talk about lots of things at the same time. So if I talk about bookness, Plato would say bookness exists, and this book participates in bookness. If we're going to talk about bookness, they would say, no, bookness does not exist in reality. It's just an idea that's a creation of my own mind, and it makes it possible for me to talk about all those books out there in the world by just using one word. It's kind of convenient. Now, the nominalists, of course, just rejected the idea that Plato had anything right that he was saying at all. It seems to me that the truth is that Plato was right about some words and wrong about other words, and about those other words, the nominalists were probably right. That is, there are some concepts that don't have some kind of thing that exists in reality that they are answerable to. The question is, what about the concept of the church? What kind of concept is that? Is the concept of the church, like the concept of a book, something that it just is? Well, no, let's not use book. Ostrich. The idea of an ostrich, Plato would say that exists in reality. It exists, as the Christians later would say, it exists in the mind of God. I think that's probably right. That's why God made those little ostriches, because he had an idea, a concept in his mind of ostrich, and he made some. And I think it's not unreasonable, it's not unhelpful to think in those terms. Yeah, in the mind of God is the concept or idea of an ostrich, and he made instances of that idea in the world. On the other hand, let's see, what would be a crowd? Let's take the word crowd. Did God have a concept or an idea of a crowd? And so he made some? Well, that's not nearly as straightforward, right? I mean, maybe God had an idea of crowds and he decided, okay, let's have some crowds. But on the other hand, maybe it's a word that just is a way that we human beings, a word that we have chosen to use to describe when you have a bunch of people together. And that it's just sort of a circumstance, an accident of circumstances, that people come together in a way that something unites them, and we call them a crowd, as a way of describing the fact that those people have come together in a particular way. I don't know if there's an idea of crowdness in the mind of God. Right? Okay, the question is, the vital question with respect to what we're talking about is, what about church? If church is an idea in the mind of God that particular instances of it are answerable to, like ostriches, then there's one and only one way to do church. It better conform to that idea in the mind of God. Because if it doesn't conform to that idea in the mind of God, then you're screwing up. You're not making your church conform to the idea. But if church describes a set of people who believe the gospel and have come together to do things that contribute to their ongoing belief and hope in that gospel, and that's all we mean by church, then there's no particular right way to do it, because there's no idea of church in the mind of God that we have to conform to. See the difference?
Why couldn't the idea of church in the mind of God be that you just described?
Well, that's possible too. You mean a vague idea, so that it doesn't really matter. Yeah, that would be possible, conceivable. The direction that the early church went in answering that question, largely influenced by this doctrine of ideas in Plato, was, well, church is a thing, and church exists in reality whether there are any churches or not. See, under the other view, if you wiped out all the believers, there wouldn't be a church any longer anywhere, right? If you killed all the believers, then the church would stop. If Plato was right, and church is one of those things that exists in the mind of God, there is still a church that exists in reality, even though there are no believers. Okay. Do you see the power of that idea? Well, then we better fall in line. I mean, we better do this right. We better make our church correct. We better make its liturgy the way God wants its liturgy to be. We better make its ritual the way God would want its ritual to be. We better make its steeples the way God would want its steeples to look, and right on down the line. There's a right way to do this thing. Well, how do we decide the right way to do this thing? Well, pardon me?
No sizzle.
Yeah.
We got to figure it out.
Yeah.
We got to figure it out, and
now we run into a problem, because we have different speculations. One person speculating one way, another person speculating another way. Egad, how are we going to do this thing? Somebody must know. Right? Somebody must know. Well, the apostles did, but they're not here. But they passed on their authority. I'm terribly oversimplifying at this point, but do you see? I mean, do you see the pressure here? Somebody has to know, and so for whatever reasons, whatever historical reasons, that authority got invested at first in the bishop of particular churches, and that was the only thing that mattered for the most part. Was that any given local community have someone who's telling us how to do it right. In time, however, with the interchange of ideas and the different local differences, the different bishops were saying different things. Well, we can't have that. I mean, when you got the Roman Empire going strong and Christianity sprouting up and all over the empire, and it was a legal religion, and there was travel and there was give and take, different bishops and the different ends of the empire were saying different things. What are we going to do about that? I mean, there can only be one truth here, right? If Plato is right, there can be only one truth. So who knows what that truth is? Well, we can come together as bishops and figure that out. And so you had the church councils, and they were engaging in largely speculative metaphysics at those church councils for the most part. There were some practical matters as well, but for the most part, it was speculative metaphysics that they were figuring out. And if we come to an impasse, how are we going to solve this impasse? Well, there's got to be one person who really has the authority to determine between the different options. And in time, you had the Bishop of Rome, it being decided that the Bishop of Rome had some kind of higher precedence, higher authority over the other bishops. And that out of that came the Pope. The Pope is the Bishop of Rome, of the Church in Rome. Yeah, actually the doctrine of papal infallibility didn't come until 15 or 1600s in terms of an actual explicit doctrine. But even though it hadn't been formulated in a doctrine, I think still the attitude toward the Pope and his authority had been that for centuries before that. Exactly how early, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Do you know, connected with the post-apostolic era that you mentioned before, that about how you said something about how that's kind of, we'll come back to that, or about how the apostles continued their...
Oh, with their talking about pastors and bishops and stuff like that?
Yeah.
What's your question?
Did they connect the Roman bishop or the Pope with that line of apostolic power?
Yes. What the defense that a Roman Catholic to this day who believes in papal authority would give is that they'd go back to the passage where Jesus says, "You are Peter, and upon this... You are Petros, and upon this Petra I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." That verse is Jesus appointing Peter as Pope, essentially, giving him the keys to the kingdom, giving him the authority of Christ himself, basically. Apostolic authority, but not just apostolic authority, the precedence among the apostles. And Peter then eventually ended up in Rome, at least according to tradition, and was the Bishop of Rome and the Pope in Rome. He wasn't called the Pope yet, but the Pope in Rome. And he then handed his authority on to the next person, who handed it on to the next person, who handed it on to the next person. And they argue for an unbroken, continuous delegation of authority straight from Peter right on down to the present-day Pope.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. How did pebble become a bedrock in three words of Jesus' statement? You are a pebble, and upon this bedrock I will build my church. And upon this, within the amount of time Jesus said that, the pebble became a bedrock. It doesn't make sense to interpret it that way.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure. Well, I think what they would argue, and I have to grant them that this is certainly plausible, is that the reason Petros is Petros is that that's the typical masculine form for a name. So that that they would argue, well, he's not really saying upon this pebble. He's giving a name that's related to the word rock, and saying, and they would argue that you, Peter, are the rock upon which I'm going to build this church. Now, I think that's a wrong exegesis of that passage. And I wouldn't argue on those grounds. I mean, I think that's legitimate. I mean, if you're going to rename somebody, then you give them a real name. And that's legitimate, I think.
In Revelation 2:6, speaking to the church at Ephesus, but you have this in your favor. You hate the practice of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. Is that not... I understand that that's supposed to be this hierarchy built.
Yeah, I've heard that before. That comes from the fact that Nicolaitans may come from two Greek words. One is Nike, or probably Nike, and the other is Laos. Laos meaning people. Nike has to do with victory. So the argument goes, the Nicolaitans are the people who are oppressing the people, having victory over the people, namely a hierarchy. I have to say that sounds like a real stretch to me. I mean, I'm more inclined to think that the Nicolaitans, whoever they were and whatever they stood for, were actually a very real movement within the church that had a certain set of beliefs, or maybe another religious, you know, maybe a mystery religion. I don't know. The problem is we don't have any historical background on them, so it's hard to know who they are. Yeah.
If you comment on Ephesians 5, I mean, it just may be the way they're using the language, using the language of the church and how Christ loves the church in relation to what you said about God having a concept of what the church is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
well, I think
it might be a different kind of concept than was handed down, but is there a concept?
I just think Ephesians 5 is talking about that set of people who God has called to have a destiny in the kingdom of God. That he doesn't mean anything more or less than that in Ephesians 5.
So church as a concept there, then you put in the same concept as crowd.
Right.
But no, I mean, even a concept of churches as a purified people, a group of purified people, I mean, does that answer the concept that if God has a concept of a... I mean, if in the mind of God there's a concept of a church, if it was... Is it the concept of a group of purified people, does that kind of qualify more like ostriches, or is that still...
Well, that I don't know. I mean, I think you could go either way on that. I don't have any problem with God having an idea in his head of a group of people.
I mean, if places like this is where then the idea of the church being this entity in and of itself, as opposed to individual believers, would have...
I think so. I mean, certainly someone who believes in institutionalism would go to a passage like that and say... I'm not just talking about Roman Catholics. I mean, I've heard Protestants... I remember going into a meeting once where a guy said, one thing you have to know about me is I'm a churchman. I frankly, I was shocked by it.
Church
Yeah. What he was trying to communicate is, I'm committed to the institution and the idea of a church. And I guess what he meant, as opposed to what he would call Lone Ranger Christians, or, you know, I don't know. But the idea that you cannot be a viable Christian without being an active, operating member of a local church, I think was the idea that he was making. It's just impossible to be a child of God in any other way, at least be a healthy child of God in any other way. And that is no less an instance of institutionalism than Roman Catholicism. I mean, never mind that he's a Protestant. The fact that my status in God's eyes is that intimately connected with my relationship with an institution is, I think, fallacious. Now understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that there's no value in Christians getting together and exhorting one another and encouraging one another. I mean, I do that. I participate in that. I'm glad that I do that. I think you should do that. I mean, that's great. But what we should do is related to what we want to accomplish, not related to what churches are supposed to be. You see what I'm saying? I don't care how you get edified. Just get edified. I don't care how you become constantly persuaded of the value of the hope of the gospel. Just be persuaded of that. And persuade the other people around you of the value of that. And I don't care if you do it over coffee, or over beer, or over a pipe, or over a baptismal. I don't care how you do it. That's what we have to do in relationship to one another. Exhort one another, persuade one another, teach one another, admonish one another, and so on. But the gathering together then is informed by wisdom. It's informed by the purposes that we have defined our lives by, not by some idea of what churches are supposed to be. In the same context, the discussion was whether people should be going to church. It was really interesting because we were referring to people who were going to a Bible study where teaching was happening, exhortation was happening, and so on and so forth. But that didn't count. Those people in the minds of this person weren't going and active in a church because it was a Bible study. But that's what I...
They had no tax exempt status.
Yeah.
They were in a
That's what I tried to pursue with him, is that, well, what exactly is deficient about this? And it was very clear that when it came right down to it, well, we all have a recognizable idea of what a church is, and that's what I mean. And so it would have been fine with him if they were going to a church that didn't believe in Jesus, that didn't believe in the hope of the gospel, and didn't encourage anyone to go to the hope of the gospel, but at least they're going to church. But to go to this Bible study where you do believe in Jesus and you do believe in the gospel, well, that doesn't really count. I mean, all you have to do is say it, and we realize how absurd that is. That's got to be ridiculous. But it's a very powerful idea in Protestants as well as Catholics.
Penny? What's believism?
Just what came out of this Greek gnosism, as that got transformed into Christianity, then it was that your salvation consists in believing the right things, having your doctrine right, having your beliefs straight, even down to having all your metaphysical speculations straight. Roger?
I don't know if there's a big argument, but there's a small argument, whether we should worship on Saturday or Sunday.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That's all part of this same idea, the same mentality, that there's a right way to do church, a right way to do worship, a right way to... Now, it was true in Old Testament religion. That was a prescribed religion, and there was a right way to do it. In fact, boy, was there a right way to do it. You even had to go about getting your mercy the right way in the Old Testament religion. I mean, it was strict. So it's not like you don't have a biblical precedent for that kind of thing, which is an important thing to realize. But the question is, does the gospel of Jesus Christ change all that or not? And the answer is no. Wrong answer. Now, obviously, that's controversial. My view is that, yeah, that changes all that.
But it's natural for a lot of Christians to think that, okay, now we're the people of God, so then they read themselves back into the Old Testament.
Right, somehow. Right, exactly. Like, it's a very understandable thing to do, but I think it's ultimately fallacious. That it misunderstands. See, what it's doing is it's reading institutionalism back into the Old Testament. It's already approaching the Bible from the standpoint of this view that salvation comes through the right institutions and going, well, then, of course, that's why God prescribed religion back there, is because he wanted them to have salvation through the right kind of religion, right? Is that what was going on back there? I would say, no, I don't think so. I think you have all kinds of clues to that effect. That's what Jesus was getting at when he says, now, what about this thing where David went in and took the showbread that only the priests were supposed to eat and fed his troops with that? What was that again? What was that all about? And I think what he's trying to say to them is, if God prescribed the religion that he did in the Old Testament because he was an institutionalist, if he had the same mentality that you guys have, then he would have struck David dead. That would have just been wrong, period. You just don't do that. But God didn't. Why not? Because God had different agenda, had different purposes for prescribing the religion that he did, and moral values were allowed to take precedence over the religious values that were instilled in that religion.
But don't touch the ark.
Yeah, but see, right. But I think the touching the ark was not. Is we misconstrue that if we think that that's punishment for a violation of a law.
You weren't even supposed to be there to begin with, for one thing.
It wasn't supposed to be carried out.
It wasn't supposed to be in Philistia to start with.
You had this rule that these guys go get it, and these are the only guys who can get it. And what was he doing there? You know, he wasn't one of them. But the thing is, it's almost not capricious, what's the word, arbitrary. When God says, okay, David, there's no sense in spending the night with your stomach ground, your guys are hungry, go get this box of bread and eat it. Give it to your people and eat it. I mean, it's just bread. And then to turn around and say, I told you not to touch the ark, and I mean it. Bam, down he goes. And not as punishment, but, you know, when I say no, I mean no. Well, he said no on the other thing, too, but he didn't mean no in the sense that you should starve over it. But on the other thing, he meant no, and I'll kill you if you violate this. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
but see, he said, don't touch the ark. Whoever touches the ark is going to die. He didn't say that about eating the showbread. He just said, don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what makes the sense to the ark was supposed to be the very presence of the power of God himself. And I'm inclined to interpret that just if it had been a 10,000-volt transformer, and it was going to fall off, and I don't know what happens with the transformer, but do you have hot wires on the transformer? I don't care how kind your intentions were. If you touch it, you die. And I think that's what God was trying to demonstrate to them there is, yes, I'm here. And I don't think in fact, I think it's wrong to interpret that story as, I don't know, I haven't heard the part about him not even supposed to be there. I'm not aware of that. But that may change what I'm about to say here. But I'm not sure that we are supposed to see him and go, oh, shame on him for touching the ark. I think we're to look at him as a hero. He saved the thing from falling in the mud and gave his life for it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm more inclined to think. We are losing it here. Let's see.
An observation I made in growing old, any institution that becomes an entity, or I guess it is an institution, it seems like it self-perpetuates and it grabs a hierarchy and it gets defensive, it gets power, it seeks more power and more power.
Absolutely.
And so that such things happen as the U of O was started by the Methodists as a college for Methodists where they could have a pure college to study in. Hmm. And
was that last 6 months or something, Alice?
Been quite a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you most people don't know, but that's why.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
This was a Methodist university.
Wow.
And how it has gone down and start naming the institutions. I mean, how many of the universities? That's right. The trend, is it not?
Right.
They were started by Christians. Right. The school system, if you would, mm-hmm. in general, was by the Christians. Now, the Christ isn't allowed in the school, and homosexuals are. And it just makes it real hard for me to say, when somebody says, let's build this fine building, you know, the question becomes, for who?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to gain them back almost don't happen.
To do what?
To gain them back to their origin almost does not happen.
Right.
They
right.
fall away and they stay away, become corrupt, and it's kind of, you know, let's build a barn and worship in there till it gets to be a cult and we'll go build us a new barn.
Yeah.
Keep cheap.
No, absolutely. It's very seductive. And once you get sucked in, it's a whole mentality that
little folks, big places made and occupied by little men.
Yeah. Now I haven't even got to the stuff I wanted to say. Let me try to go over this really fast. Get to the main point. What is my critique of papalism? I mean, in a way, I've already given you that in terms of where I'm showing you it came from and how I think its roots are fallacious to start with, granted. But aside from that, never mind that. It seems odd to me. I have three things. But I'll only talk about... I have four things. I'll talk about two of them. I'll talk about one of them. I probably ran out of time. Here's the most telling one for me, I think. The claim that the Roman Catholic doctrine makes about the Pope goes beyond anything that the New Testament claims for the apostles. And that's the most striking thing to me of all. Here's what I mean. In Galatians, when you read Galatians, it's very, very revealing. Paul says things like, if I or an angel from heaven should preach to you another gospel other than the one that's already been delivered to you, let him be accursed. And the interesting thing is not so much the angels in heaven, but the I part. If I should come and preach to you a different gospel other than the one that's already been delivered to you, let me be accursed. If Paul believed in apostolic authority in the way that the Roman Catholics believe in papal authority, there's no way in the world that he could say that. Because the... maybe that's going a little bit too far. But the question is, what is the locus of authority in the apostles? Is it in the person? Is it, I'm an apostle, so whatever I say is true? No, clearly not. Because Paul foresees a circumstance where he could say something different than what he's saying now, and he'd say, let me be anathema. Is it in the office of apostleship? Well, no, it's not even that. Because he's holding the office, but he could conceive of out of that office saying something that's not true. Saying something that's, and something that's not true on the issue of the gospel, the nature of the gospel itself. What then is the locus of authority for an apostle? It seems like there's only one way to... another part of Galatians, let me back up. He goes on in the next chapter to say, you know, I received my teaching directly from Jesus, and I started preaching to the Gentiles, and then the people from the circumcision party came and started bugging us, and I got concerned, because they said they were from James. They said they were from the church at Jerusalem. So when I went down with the offering that I brought to Jerusalem, to the church at Jerusalem, I was very interested and very concerned to get together with the Peter and whatever his name, and I laid out my gospel before them to make sure that I had not run in vain. See what he's saying? I'm an apostle appointed by Jesus, but I'm convinced that the truth is the truth, and the truth I'm teaching is going to be the same truth that the other apostles are teaching, and if it's not, something's wrong. And so I had to check it out. And he said, lo and behold, I laid it out, and they could add nothing to me. That is, they corrected me in no way. They said, right on, that's right. But the thing is, that was important to Paul. That was an issue for Paul. Because he could conceive of, theoretically, him, even though he had been appointed as an apostle, getting it wrong. That was conceivable to him. All right. If the locus of authority then is not in the person, and it's not in the office, where is it? And it seems to me that the only way to understand the New Testament is to understand the locus of apostolic authority to be in the inspired understanding that they believe had been delivered to them, that they believe had been given to them. Their message was authoritative only insofar as it lined up with what Jesus had taught them, with what Jesus had told them, and with what the Spirit of God had opened their eyes to see and to understand. The authority rested in the message, not in the person, and not in this thing called an office. They're called apostles not because it was an office with authority, but because it was a responsibility that they had been charged with. They had been delegated by Jesus to go off and take this message that had been delivered to them and proclaim it, announce it. That's what made them apostles. It wasn't some kind of extraordinary authority in that office that they held. But they did have an extraordinary authority insofar as they had been granted to know and understand the gospel with an inspired kind of understanding. And that message carried authority. Okay. Now, do you see how different that is then when we turn around years later and we say the office of the Pope has authority? And they qualify that. The office of the Pope only has authority when he is speaking ex cathedra, that is, when he is speaking out of his office as Pope. So it's not, the locus of authority is not in the person, and it's not even in the office all the time. But it is in the office insofar as he is exercising his office, then he has authority and is speaking infallibly. Even Paul couldn't have said that, is my point. Even Paul couldn't have said that. And he was an apostle. So they're making a claim in terms of the nature of the authority that they're ascribing to the Pope. They're making a claim about that authority that wasn't even true of the first generation of apostles. As I read the New Testament. I just encourage you to read through Galatians and think in those terms. How is Paul thinking of his authority as he writes this thing? And I think it'll be very striking to you.
Right in that section of Galatians also, that really could dovetail quite well with what you just said about the office of the Pope and the apostles themselves and how they view themselves is when Paul calls Peter on the carpet for getting it wrong.
Right.
And here's Peter.
Right.
The rock to which the church is built on. So what? The Pope now is, I mean, his power has gradually become even greater than Peter's? I don't think so. Not the Father.
Now, that excellent point. Because how is it, that on what basis, on what authority is Paul calling Peter on the carpet? Because there is this authoritative understanding of the gospel that they are both answerable to. And to the extent that their actions or words are not lining up with that, they're messing up. And Paul is bringing Peter to an awareness of that and saying, Peter, that's not the truth that you're representing there. That's where the authority... Pardon me?
Somebody got ham on your breath.
it occurred to me that that's a very interesting observation. Out of Galatians, being that Galatians, along with 1 Corinthians, is a book where Paul is really wielding his authority
right.
to the extent that, you know, he ever wields it in Scripture.
Right.
And yet, you know, he limits it like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah.
The language there is almost like, as Ron took us through Galatians there, that... it's just like this thing's going to blow up. If we don't get this right, If we don't clean this up, then it's over. Almost.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, too, where Paul is talking about marriage, and he says, I tell you this, I counsel you this, not the Lord, but I counsel you this. So he recognized that the Lord would speak certain things which he had been taught, and the other things were just his opinion of things he said. Mm-hmm. He didn't want people to feel like they were being totally bound up.
Yeah, I think that is a very revealing comment. Some people misconstrue that to... not that you meant this, but some people suggest that when he says it's just my opinion, that therefore you don't have to pay any attention to it, which I don't think that's what he's saying. Because he goes on to say, but I think I have the mind of the Lord in this. That what he's saying is, I am speaking out of my inspired understanding of these things. I can't quote you a quote of Jesus on this issue, but I think I understand what he believed about this. That's basically what he's saying. But the kind of qualified language that he uses to express it, I think, is significant. And that I think, is your point, is that it seems to allow for the possibility that... I mean, it's not this kind of dogmatic, I'm Paul and I'm never wrong. He's sort of theoretically entertaining the notion that, you know, maybe, I suppose maybe I could get this wrong. But then he goes on and turns around and says, but I don't think so. I think I have this one right.
I think, too, if I can comment real quick, that... You recognize historically they were in a situation where they were under a lot of persecution, obviously, and there were certain things going on, and that would affect a lot of their choices. And what he recommended would be best for different people.
Right, right.
And so he probably realized that in the future, however long that might be, that it may not apply to every Christian in every situation, too.
Yeah. Good point. My first one was the superfluous nature of apostolic authority being passed down if A, Christianity is the existential commitment that I claim it is, and B, the scriptures contain the inspired understanding of the apostles. If we have an ongoing basis in the scriptures, whatever it is the apostles would have to say to us, then apostolic succession makes no sense. In other words, see, in the early church, they felt the necessity of there being apostolic succession, somebody telling them what the truth is, because they had to get church right. But if this is not about doing church, but is about having a passionate commitment to the hope of the kingdom of God, and that's all Christianity is, and the apostles have told us everything we ever need to know about that, then there's no need for apostolic succession. It's superfluous. It's totally unnecessary. We've got everything we need to know right here from the mouth of the apostles, pen of the apostles themselves. And so, but if you think of Christianity differently, if Christianity is all about doing your institution right, then it makes sense that you'd have to have apostles alive and well and solving your problems for you. But it's superfluous if Christianity is this existential thing that I've been talking about. Second point was the one that I just made. Third point, Jesus himself did not establish church structures nor teach church authority. If it is true that the Pope has the authority ascribed to him, that is very odd indeed that Jesus did not teach it. And then we could look at that Matthew 16 passage, because that's the passage that they would go to. But I would simply argue that they've misconstrued that. The foundation that he's talking about is the understanding that Jesus is the Messiah. I think that's the rock upon which he will build his church. It's the confession that Jesus is the Messiah. Because in the context, that's what's just happened. He said, "Who do men say that I am?" He says, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And that's when he turns and says, flesh and blood didn't reveal that to you, but the Spirit of God revealed that to you. I mean, that's right. That's miraculously right, what you just said, Peter. And it's people getting that miraculously right that's going to be the foundation of his church, the bedrock of his church. And then I could say the same thing about the apostles. It's equally odd that the apostles don't establish those church structures. Now, people would probably point to things like Timothy, where it gives qualifications for deacons and elders and things like that. But what you never have any statement of anywhere in the New Testament is anything ascribing authority to them. They're pastors. They're more mature people who can shepherd, can guide, can teach, can admonish. But there's no indication, and serve, yeah, there's no indication that they have some kind of hierarchical authority. Just nothing like that in the New Testament. Well, if that's what it's all about, it's really odd that that doesn't show up in the New Testament, seems to me. Very odd. Which makes me think that's not what it's all about. Yeah. I need to let you go.